Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. Now listen, you're listening to the Casterbridge podcast with a K. Don't worry about other podcasts. Let them gawp. Let them gape. Yes, did you know that we're available on Casterbridge.com, iTunes, Stitcher.com and Audioboo? Well, you do now. Good, isn't it?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's podcast with a K. Joining me this week is James McLean.
Thank you.
And I am John Guiler, pretending to be Brian Terranova.
Very good.
Yeah.
It should be quite exciting. See how long you can keep the accent up.
Well, you know, it's a bit difficult. You know, it's a bit rubbish, his accent, really. I don't know if you've ever noticed, but it doesn't really sound truly American. It's very hard to do. It's almost like David Tennant.
You're losing it already.
I know. It's so hard. Hold on. I'll just compose. All right. But just wait. I've got one moment here while I put it together. Okay. So how's that? Is this better? Is this me?
Yeah, I think if you can hold it for the next 40 to 50 minutes, we'll be good.
This is rough. This is rough to do. But, you know, I think we should tell you all. Christian Colley has the week off. So yeah. That's why you've got to put up with James and I, Brian. Right?
Brian.
Is that how you say it? Pronounce it? Anyway, whatever. What are we talking about this week? Sherwood, right?
Yeah, I think Sherwood is high on the agenda. I think mainly that because there's obviously been a little bit of controversy around this one, which...
Yeah.
Will be which we will touch upon.
Here before we get to the controversy,
yeah.
And this is stupid. I should have checked it. I've watched it twice now, and both times I forgot to look at it. You know when they announce the episode titles?
Yeah.
And you're given the episode titles, and you just kind of, when you watch the episode, I don't know about you, but I just kind of gloss over reading them sometimes because, you know, while the opening credits are going, I'm checking my phone like an idiot instead of watching the show. So twice now I've missed it. I remembered it being announced as Robot of Sherwood, but there were plenty of them. So is it actually Robots of Sherwood? I could check this, and I may sound like a complete idiot asking on the podcast rather than checking it myself, but I figured you might just know off the bat and save me the trouble.
I think it is Robot. I think it is singular.
But why?
Is
it denoting the sheriff?
I think it's more to carry the play on the pun of Robin being a singular. So the
I see.
Robot being a singular. And I think possibly also it's playing on the notion that you go in thinking that it's going to be Robin. So it's a sort of maybe a little bit of
a fake out.
It's a bit of a bit of a fake out to trick you.
Yeah.
So what was your feelings on it?
On the episode?
Yeah.
Okay. I will say when it originally started, I was kind of really not liking the tone so much.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, obviously I remembered, you know, it's Robin Hood, and that's kind of the type of stuff you get with Robin Hood. And that went away in the final moments of the story when Robin kind of, you know, let the doctor know, yes, it's essentially all the guys I put on to give people hope and whatnot. And I thought a lot better about that.
Mm-hmm.
So that made me like... Certainly going into it a second time, it made me really appreciate the story more. But honestly, I enjoyed it. I had like a couple qualms with it, you know, two little things. One of them being the sword spoon fight scene. Because,
right.
You know, I have a very good imagination. I have a very great suspension of disbelief. There are so many things that I enjoy that I can just put aside because, you know, I don't care how ridiculous it is. But there's no way a spoon would have been able to stop a sword, not with the type of thrusts he was putting into that, you know? And it's just, it seems like a silly idea that might be funny for a second or two, but then you realize it might have been better for, like, Robin Hood Men in Tights, not a Doctor Who episode.
You see, the problem is here is you've given away that you're not Brian, because Brian would have loved that scene, because he'll now be able to go and get that spoon and put it with his collection. So, yeah, clearly...
I haven't done research then.
No, you've not researched the character properly.
You know, okay, you know, you see, this is what happens when you guys give me last-minute jobs like this. You know? I will do more. The other qualm?
Yeah.
The other qualm was that you can shoot an arrow and hit the hull of a spaceship, And it will just give that spaceship enough fuel to take off a little bit further. Because, you know, that makes sense. But aside from that, I honestly didn't have much. I would say maybe the fact that the episode kind of seemed a little bit more like it was actually written for Matt Smith, the way that Capaldi was
acting. Interesting. Yeah.
I definitely felt there were, like, you know, with him going and plucking out the hair and taking the blood samples and telling people, like, you know, you've got 6 months to live and you can't be real. You know, I liked the concept of it because it was kind of like Robin Hood can't be real. It seemed like those moments were very, like, writing for Pertwee kind of situation, you know. Not that it was bad, because I like seeing the diversity with Peter. I like seeing, you know, the darker side. I like seeing the other side of it. But so far, of the three episodes, I would say this has probably been my least favorite. And by no means does that mean it was bad and I didn't enjoy it. It just was, out of the three, it was like the least. It was the weakest, I guess, but not horribly weak. But I just, you know, watching Peter do those silly moments, it is good. It is fun. And I really enjoyed the banter between he and Robin. But I was actually just trying to explain this the other day. There was something so beautiful to me in the Into the Dalek story when he saves Journey Blue and he comes back and her uncle is talking to him. And, you know, he has that line where he says, "I wish I could have done more." And uncle says, "Well, you should have." And then he's just, "Okay." You know, just how brilliantly subtle he played that entire conversation right there. Once he leaves the TARDIS, that conversation, that was something that I absolutely adored about his doctor so far. So to see him be a little bit more all over the place in this episode, it was weird. I won't say jarring, because obviously he's a new doctor. We're just getting to learn about him, but it was weird to see. But we got to see some of that subtlety in this story too, so I'm okay with it. But anyway, those are my feelings.
Do you think it would have worked better than, I mean, obviously there might be essences of this story which may play out later, we don't know, but on a presumption it doesn't, do you think this would have been a better sort of Love and Monsters episode 9-10 slot?
That's a good question. It definitely does seem like an episode after you've had a whole bunch of like heavy-handed ones, that this would be the one to throw in there to kind of give people a break. And we've really only had two episodes.
Mm.
I don't know. You know, it honestly, no. Here's the thing. Like I said, I don't think it was a horrible episode by any means. I enjoyed the episode. And certainly, like I said, my first time round, I had some reservations about the jovial nature of Robin and his gang and so on. I would have wanted to see a more reality perspective of it, but it is a legend. They were trying to harken back to the legend and the movies and the TV shows and all the different stories out there, including one thing my girlfriend had told me, which I didn't even pick up on, so I'd never seen it, which I'll get to in a minute. But I think it works in this slot simply because of the jovial nature of it, because in the first episode you have the whole did he or didn't he situation of the doctor throwing the clockwork robot from the the ship, if you want to call it a ship.
Yeah, the escape pod.
Yeah, thank you, escape pod. And in Into the Dalek, you have how he kind of just very casually throws off someone dying. You know, two people actually in the story, Journey's brother and then the guard that he had to eat whatever the power cell was or whatever it was so that he could track him, you know, and then even, you know, saying he was a top layer, if you just want to say a few words kind of thing. You have this very kind of darker twist to him and very heavy-handed. And I know from just even my friends out there, some of them felt it was like kind of like, oh, what happened to that funny, silly guy, you know? And so I think it's nice to kind of throw it at them early, because if you kept a whole series of these heavy aspects, and then for the 10th episode or so, 9th or 10th, you get this one. Some people might think it's a little too late, but if you start to throw everything of who he is in early, I think it's a wise idea. Because even for me, like I said, it was odd at first to see it, because I had really been liking the tone of him prior to, but I knew I still wanted some silly in him, because it's the doctor, you know, some of it's got to be there, in my opinion. But
I sort of felt this would actually be a better episode too. I felt that it'd have been a nicer segue to the end of episode one. Episode Into the Dalek, as I said last week, I think, was very Dalek focused, which. Mm. And the end of the first episode was on a sort of slightly lighter beat, their relationship at the end. which to me felt married a little more with the opening to this episode when they're in the TARDIS. Felt like that just sort of segued better to the end of episode one. And it gave... I've heard people disagree on this. I thought it gave Capaldi quite a good platform for the Doctor because it wasn't so focused on the enemy. It allowed him to breathe a bit more. Although I've heard other people say they felt that it didn't. It was too much focused on Robin. So I suppose that's argumentative. But episode two, I personally think it would have made a better episode two and then bring Danny Pink in on episode three. So you get a couple of episodes with Capaldi and Clara before you start moving. But again, we don't know the whole thrust of the series yet. So,
yeah, that I don't know. That, I definitely think that could have worked. You know, like I said, doing it in the early stages of his era would have just been better either way. So one or rather two or three, I don't think it would have been so bad. I see where you're coming from. You know, it could have definitely worked in the number two slot. However, Into the Daleks so far, I think, was the best one they've told this season.
All right. Okay.
And I think having it be number two, because think about it, what you get with number one, you get the Scooby gang back for an episode. You get that dinosaur situation that we talked about. You get a new doctor and you get a rehashed story, you know, which is fine. You're introducing a new doctor. That's the focus of your story. I get it, you know, but if we had gone from that to this kind of silly tone episode two, I think some people might have started to be concerned, you know? So
yes, that's true.
I think hitting them with Dalek, which is Moffat's best Dalek story since his era began. I think it was probably a wise call that way. Cause this way you get to see the basic first Doctor episode and then bam, you get to see the strengths and then you get to see, but we still can have fun.
Okay. That's a fair enough appraisal. I like this one a lot, actually. I wasn't, obviously, as we talked about in the run-up to the series, I think it was one that we were all a little concerned about so far as the title and the content seemed a bit vapid. But I really liked it. I think for the humour, I can understand why some people might have been a bit turned off by it. There was a couple of moments where it did go a little childish, farcical. But then if you're a 10-year-old kid, I think you'd have really liked that. So, you know, you've got to remember it's not just darkness for the adults. There's got to be a little bit of levity and lightness for kids there as well.
Yeah.
And I think this was fun. What I thought was actually quite clever when I rewatched it was at first one of the things that got me was that the costumes were so, they felt unrealistic. Now, I've never looked at sort of 12th century attire, but I didn't feel really that Robin reflected that. But then at the same time, it made a very good red herring because it left you thinking like the Doctor was at the beginning, that this was all a fake, that this was all a mini scope, or it wasn't true history. And then you got to think, well, there's something that made me think is when he talked about that he had sparring lessons with Richard the Lionheart, and it made me think, well, this is actually technically roughly about the same time as the Crusade. And in a sense, you can have slightly naffer costumes because sometimes Doctor Who did. And if you want to see the whole of Doctor Who as one continuity, then, you know, like The Time Warrior, for instance, where you've got that sort of very 70s BBC drama approach to the costuming. If you want to believe in the Doctor Who universe, that's how it looked. Then you can have slightly Errol Flynn-ish sort of costumes for Robin Hood, because there is in the Doctor Who canon, there is that sort of costume flamboyance, if you see what I mean. So it sort of carries, in a sense, it sort of almost is a homage to the eras of the past, as much as not just Errol Flynn, but maybe to Doctor Who's eras of the past.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought, because I will say that was one of the things that I did find odd, that, you know, with the way the BBC drama works these days and their costume department for period pieces is generally well-renowned, you know. So it did strike me a little bit odd that they were so, you know, again, using the Robin Hood Men in Tights thing, it seemed more like, more fitting of a comedy, or more fitting of, like you said, an Errol Flynn kind of style one. But that's an interesting theory, what you've got there. Definitely that, you know, there you can have like kind of an in-house continuity. But also, I think it did lend itself well better to the jovial nature of the story.
Yes,
you
know, it did.
Because if you had gone ahead with Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves types outfits, type outfits, for instance, it wouldn't have worked quite as well. I would have felt that the actor playing Robin Hood would have been over the top for what he was doing. But you get that guy in the costume he's wearing, and forgive me, I've completely forgotten his name, and I just looked it up earlier too, but you get him in the outfit that he's wearing, it totally fits the script. So, and you know, and credit where it's due there actually too, is they realized the nature of the script, and somebody said, well, look at this script, these are the outfits that would be appropriate, and they approved that rather than going, yeah, but we want it to be a real gritty period piece, you know, like they know the tone, which is very good.
And it did, I don't know about for you, but it did sow the seeds of distrust that it was Robin and his gang that were the fakes.
Yeah.
In the world. Well, you know what the thing was, playoff.
Yeah, there were two things about that. Like when it first started, I had kind of expected it to actually be Robin Hood, and I kept hoping that it would be. My personal theory was that it was going to be some guy from the future,
right,
or maybe his friends from the future, and they either got stuck in the past and decided to be the legend, or were going back to be the legend on purpose because maybe they were hunting this robot. You know, I thought that's what it was. But the second that they kind of had the doctor be so distrusting of whether or not he was real, that's when I knew that it was really Robin Hood. So while it did kind of sow the seeds, it was the amount of time that they spent having the doctor not believe that he was really Robin Hood, which made me realize he really was Robin Hood.
I did start to wonder whether he would actually, there'd be a twist later in the series and it'd be Robin who turns out to be the master. There was just some camaraderie there, and such a red, you could play a Joker card like that so easily, especially with, which we're going to go on to next, I think, with Ben Miller looking so much like Anthony Ainley through it, that you would start to think that he might be something to do with the master, that you swing it around to be Robin. I don't know. But yeah, I thought it was good. I think the payoff was quite sweet. I think Gatiss has, and I don't want to sound patronizing like this as some sort of backseat writer, but I think his writing has improved a lot so far that I felt that the payoff at the end, like with Adventures in Time and Space, sort of worked with what you were given. It felt quite a mature twist, even though, as you say, you could probably guess that was what was coming. It was quite a nice one because it did defy the nature of the audience expectation to a degree, and it also defined the nature of the show, where I think, you know, if it had been done in 1984, he would have been a robot, or he would have been a person from the future, most likely a person from the future.
Yeah.
So I think it was quite a daring thing to turn around and go, no, the Doctor, if the Doctor's allowed to be this larger-than-life legend, why can't Robin be allowed to be a larger-than-life legend? Why can't you just deal with that audience? And I thought that was quite a ballsy spin around. So, yeah. So Ben Miller, I think, is probably next on the list as the sheriff. How were you with Ben?
The entire time I was watching him, I kept going, where do I know this man from? I must have seen him in tons of things, and I couldn't pinpoint it. I liked him. I liked the portrayal. It was, you know, as much as we talk about how Robin was, and I don't want to say, I'm going to say over the top, but I actually don't mean over the top.
Yes, you don't mean it in a negative way. Yeah.
Yeah. Like definitely for modern representations of the character, they chose a different approach. So as much as they went with that kind of jovial kind of like larger than life kind of approach, they grounded the sheriff. They grounded him. And I thought that was great. I thought that was really good because you do want, in my opinion, the threat to be a proper threat.
Yes.
When you remove the actual danger or thrust of the proper threat, you lose a lot. And that's what happened with, since you brought it up earlier, that's what happened to me with Love and Monsters.
Yeah.
Once you made that alien, actually Love and Monsters and the cousin of Love and Monsters, the Aliens of London.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a shame because Aliens of London, I still think, is a good story. They just made the aliens, again, like Robin, too jovial. But unlike Robin, it didn't work for them.
Yeah.
It worked for Robin very well, but it didn't work for them. So once you do that, you just kind of, you remove things and the story doesn't, there's no threat. I don't see a threat. It doesn't become fun.
Yeah.
With the sheriff, I thought he was very well played. And I loved... I loved how, you know, like you start to learn a little bit more. Not only is he working with these robots, but he's got an understanding of them. He's got an understanding of their technology. He has more of an understanding than you would expect, obviously, for someone of their era, even just trying to piece together, like, okay, they tell me this is an engine. I understand that's an engine. Thank you. You know, no, he's embedded, and it's very good. I thought he was very well played.
Did you watch Doc Martin? I can't remember if you were one.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Yeah, Ben Miller was the ranger with the traps in the wood. He kept getting
his.
That's
who he was. Okay.
He's done. Yes. He's done many things. He was in. What's that? Death in Paradise was it called? My brain's going. I think he did a bit in Primeval, didn't he? As well. Armstrong and Miller as a comedian. He was the second side of the comedy partner. Alexander Armstrong being in the Witch in the Wardrobe episode as the pilot. He was his comedy partner. So he's got quite a lot of English connections. I got to speak to him actually this weekend, which was rather cool.
Nice.
At a local convention. He's a lovely guy.
Oh, wow.
So what's about Clara? Because Clara again had what I think a lot of people, including and even in our review on Casterbris, which I think is probably quite fair, she had a little bit more meat than most companions for this episode. There's a little more substance for her to play with.
I think this whole season she has been. She's really come into her own this season in such a way that, you know, like I don't think of her as a plot device anymore. Mm. I think of her as a character. Which is a great thing. I think she's doing really well, and I'm enjoying her being on the TARDIS.
Yes. I liked it with her. Again, as I said, I was complaining last week the way that they dropped her off again, but I liked this week the way it opened up with her. Yes. Just there. There was no comment on how long she'd been there.
Absolutely, yeah. You know that's one of my big pet peeves, how... Mm. You know, the doctor, you know, it's fine. You know, it was a little annoying with Amy and Rory, but then you understand that they're married and they have a life, and that's okay. I get that. When you got to Clara, it was kind of, you know, it was kind of like when you had Rose Tyler and her family, and we kept going back to Earth for that. And then you get to Martha Jones, and the idea is already old.
Yeah.
You know, and yet you're still doing it. But then you get to Donna, and you still have the same idea, but you're starting to work it out a little bit more, which is okay, but you maybe should have stepped away from it a little bit further anyway. Then you get to Stephen Moffat's era, and to his credit, he realized, I can't keep doing the family thing. Russell's done it to death. You know, so instead, he found another way to keep bringing them back to Earth, which was by making his companions want to live their lives. And it's actually interesting because it's different than what we got before. Repeating it again with Clara, though, is going a step too far. So I was very glad to see the beginning of this episode that it seems like they can be off on adventures for a while. But, you know, unfortunately, we do know, you know, she's got to get back to Danny Pink somehow. So
I think what is a little frustrating with this is I kind of feel there's a slight sort of commercial aspect to this. Is they create nice merchandise holes. They can now drop in books or stories in between pieces. Like you can now have a piece here, a gap where you could have 20 stories with Clara and the Doctor, and prior to Into the Dalek, 20 stories with the Doctor by himself. And I hope it's not so. I still think personally, and this is just personally, and I'm always wary about saying this because you hear so many fans go into classic mode and say the classic mode's the only way to do it.
Right.
But I still think it, with Amy and Rory and with Clara, it would be more interesting and I think more evolving for kids and adults if they were just on the TARDIS, as if Amy and Rory were married on the, you know, like Ian and Barbara, but married, living day to day in the TARDIS. Yeah. I think that's far more involving for kids. I can understand why Russell did it to start the show up, to give it some grounding for viewers, but almost 10 years on, I kind of feel that would be more interesting. It's not about it being traditional. It's not about it being the only way. It's not about it being the way that Doctor Who should be done. I just feel that would be more exciting. It'd be more like we've said this before, taking a voyage with these people. So, it does frustrate me quite a lot. So it's really nice that this one opened in that way. So, I agree with you. I think Clara had a nice role. She got to play again in some of the comedy, which she does very well. Jenna does the comedy very well. I suppose before we go on to the censorship, how do you feel about the interaction between Robin and the Doctor? Because it was very heavy, wasn't it, in this episode? That was a very major key part of it.
Yeah, it was heavy. And I know that in the beginning, you had talked a little bit about people complaining that maybe there was a little too much Robin. I don't think I can agree with that, because I think you're going to bring in such a legendary character like that, and if you are really working hard to make them be real or put a mystery on it, you really got to use them. And I did think it was fun. I felt, you know, maybe at times some of it got a little too much, but really all I remembered was thinking it was fun, especially all their banter when they were tied up in the cell together. Mm-hmm. I think one of my favorite Robin moments actually was, you know, out of all the laughter that he did, even especially watching it a second yes. time around, but I caught this on the first time, but with all the laughter that he did, and then at the very end when he tells the doctor, you know, why he does it, and you get that most of his laughter is just, you know, for show.
Yeah.
But the moment that you get when the doctor tells him that, you know, they need to go find a blacksmith area so that he can create, and I forgot what he said now, but what, you know, and Robin found that to be truly funny.
Yeah.
And he was truly laughing there, and he was actually enjoying himself there. And I found that to be really good, because especially when you do know the end again, like I said, where his laughter is for show. But to see right there that there was a genuine moment where he was actually starting to enjoy the doctor, and you also had a moment in there where the doctor was actually starting to enjoy him. I liked that.
Yeah. There were some nice moments of that. I did like his that line in the cell where he says he can feel another laugh coming on, you know, as he's taunting yeah. him. There was just, and at the same time, there were some quite nice dark lines for Capaldi as well. I mean, you know, it opens up with his comment about, you know, have you ever been punched in the face? And,
right.
You know, that was the way it was delivered, carried the darkness to it, you know. So it's nice that you could carry the consistency, and of course with the 6 months to live. Although I have heard it said by other people, they still feel, and I can sort of see this, I must admit, it does almost feel like you've had three different versions of the Doctor in three different episodes. It doesn't. I can understand that, even though I can see links between the personality. Could be the tones of the episode, but it does almost feel like it's almost been like three different interpretations. They don't marry perfectly yet for me, and that I think is probably to do with the choices of style.
Yeah. I think it's more to do with that, because I can understand where they're coming from. The thing is, though, certainly with the first episode, I don't know if we can ever truly judge a doctor on their first
yeah.
episode
yes,
for their
that's
personality.
True.
And we did get a bit of, like, in my opinion, I think we got a bit of all of this in there, because we had a lot of the comedy, we had the dark stuff, and we also had the absent-minded, like, crazy guy all in one kind of episode. With Dalek, we definitely had more of a darker tone. And more of the serious one. So there definitely was a tonal shift here, but hopefully as stories progress, we'll get to see stories where he can utilize them all in an episode rather than have them just be episode-specific type things. But at the same time, that was kind of one of my issues with Matt Smith. Even when there were really serious moments, or I should say more often than not, even when there were serious moments, he was too manic and silly and all over the place for me.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with this, it seems like at least they're doing it in fitting moments. So I don't mind it with Peter, because at least it's fitting. You know, there were times when you know, and we've talked about it before, and I always bring up, like, one of my favorite moments was when Matt Smith had that conversation with Solomon in the Dinosaurs on a Spaceship.
Yeah.
That one, and when he tells the crew, you know, don't ever lie to me, you know, his friends,
yeah.
don't ever lie to me. Like, those are great moments, and I really think that they should have written more scenes, like, especially when you're coming face-to-face with a villain, more scenes like that. Even his first story, he had one like that, you know? And it's just there were some times where he was just a little too silly. And I do, honestly, I don't know about you, but I actually take big issues. I have a big issue with the Doctor and the companions enjoying the danger.
Yes, absolutely.
And I know that started yes. with Russell, but I still have issues with that. You know,
yes.
like one of my favorite things about the classic series, and why Sarah Jane Smith will always be the best companion to me, because so far I haven't seen anybody come close to her, is that when it was fun, you enjoyed the fun. When there was danger, she showed that there was danger. She showed that there was fear, but that she could confront
yeah.
it. And even Tom Baker did that,
and even
John Pertwee did it. But Tom Baker was the one thing, and I remember even hearing him in an interview once where he said, you know, the kids need to know this is dangerous. They need to know it's danger, but I can't show too much because I also need to show them that I'm going to beat them. I'm going to save the day. And I get that philosophy. But if you go into it too hard, where you're just laughing at danger all the time, just like with the Sheriff of Sherwood, if they had made him as jovial as they made Robin, it wouldn't work. And yeah. that was a lot of my issues with the writing for the Smith era, and it seems like they're dancing away from that right now. As a matter of fact, I was saying just yesterday, it's amazing to me, because I remember when Stephen Moffat was announced to be the new showrunner, and I was excited, because consistently his stories in Russell's era were some of the best. Mm-hmm. So I was excited, because I thought, wow, okay, this guy knows Doctor Who. This is cool. This will be good. You know, it'll be the change that the show kind of does need at this point, you know? And what we got, I was, you know, I don't want to say disappointed, because that's unfair. There were some good ones in there. But I was, you know, I can't find a better word. I was disappointed. Mm. Watching this season with Peter Capaldi starting off now, all the way up into his third episode, it's like what I had wanted.
Yeah.
Back yeah. when we first heard Moffat was taking over. So it seems like, I don't know if it's because of your actor, I don't know if it's because you learned something with the past 3 years, or you got that silliness out of your system. Whatever it is, it's working, and I'm hoping it continues. The whole Missy situation still has me concerned, just because I personally, I'm not a fan of the acting of the actress right now.
Yeah.
We'll see how it pays off. But also, I'm not a big fan of, like, just the way it's already playing out, and Moff's track record, you know, with Archer.
It was nice to have that thrown out, although, again, I if I was to have a criticism, it's not of the story, but of the approach to the season, I still think arcs are becoming very old hat. And while The Promised Land featured this in a way which was contextually relevant to the story,
yeah,
I still feel that they bolt down and take away some of the freedom and lack of linear to Doctor Who, which is what Doctor Who, to me, always enjoyed, was the fact that there was no linear nature to it.
Yeah.
It was free roam, and when you've got, you know, having to go back to go and get the companion, and you've got the, it's, you know, if you're an American person and you're listening to this, an American person, it always reminds me a bit of the A-Team. In the first few seasons of the A-Team, they always used to have to go back to get Murdoch out of the asylum before right. doing that. And the later seasons, they obviously thought, oh, sod that, he's just with them. And it worked far better, because you just imagine that they were all just anywhere in the country roaming around, like Knight Rider, to go for another one of the same ilk with Kit. It just felt more free roam. And I think free roam is really quite powerful. And I couldn't stress that enough, if there are any of the writers listening to this. It's not about it being about old Doctor Who. It's about that. I just think it gives the show so much more freedom.
So, yeah. And you take the story arc kind of idea. It is interesting that somebody can be following the Doctor all throughout his adventures for a season.
Mm-hmm.
But you get it for every season.
Yes, that's the problem, yeah.
It seems like what he does is a little bit less special now, because apparently everybody can do it too.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, it definitely was a big detractor for me, but I will say the way it was handled in Robots of Sherwood was way better handled than how it was in Into the Dalek, because Into the Dalek, I really felt removed from the story when she showed up. Whereas in Robots of Sherwood, I liked that, you know, it was mentioned on a screen. He realized the revelation, you know, that hey, I've heard this before. It felt a little better. It didn't feel like it was removed. It felt like there was a mystery that he's now clocking onto, you know, and I like that much more.
So let's hit that thorny issue of censorship. As people who probably watched it may or may not have known, depending on whether they read the papers, but there was an edit in there that was a fairly substantial in terms of minutes, or within seconds, actually. I think it was not minutes, but of a beheading due to recent events. The BBC were looking for a sensitivity approach. I think the way that we're looking at this is how it affected the story. And I suppose I think we can also touch on whether we felt that it was whether it is necessary that cultural events should have such an impact on drama, I suppose, on fiction.
Yeah.
So how do you feel on the first part? How do you think it felt with the episode itself?
By not having it in the episode?
Yeah, do you think it caused any damage? Did you feel that it was... Well, okay, if you did not know about it, first of all, do you feel that you would have noticed it? And secondly, because you knew about it, did you feel that it would have been better if it had not had the edit for the story itself?
Yeah. You know, I should, you know, you bring up a thing I wish I had before the podcast. I had asked my girlfriend because we just watched it before the podcast and she didn't know about the edit. With myself, I knew about the edit. So I kept looking for where it would fit in. Mm-hmm. I didn't see it. I didn't feel an odd edit. So knowing about the edit, it didn't seem like anything was missed. And I had heard, I read a comment out there that somebody said it really helped explain the sheriff, that he was half machine or at least fully a robot or something, because it was directly relating to that, which, you know, we had the sheriff tell us essentially he was a cyborg. You know, it was in his dialogue. So since it was in his dialogue, it was still within the story. Having the beheading be missing, I personally, from not having seen what it looked like with the beheading in it, I didn't really feel like I missed anything.
So, I mean, first of all, that would suggest that as a casual viewer, you don't think it would have been particularly noticed. And as a viewer who was aware of it, it didn't spoil your enjoyment or take you out of the moment.
No, it didn't. It didn't. I will say, I mean, and we'll get to another part here in a second, but I will say the fact that they put so much attention on the fact that they were taking it out made me look for it and made me realize one other thing, which I was very surprised by.
Okay, I'll ask this and go back to what the other thing is that you're surprised by. Do you think that there is a mistake in the BBC to pull such attention to the fact there's been an edit? I mean, I must admit, I've been very busy this week, so I've not been following it closely to see whether it was actually press released or whether this was something picked up secondary. But it sometimes feels that if an edit had to be done, if it wasn't drawn attention to, which in a sense, the whole point of an edit is so it doesn't draw attention to it.
Right.
Would it be better in that sort of sense? Is it because it becomes so much more of an issue because it's highlighted, if you see what I mean?
I think things become more of an issue because people make them an issue, which is just the unfortunate truth. And by that, I don't mean the BBC. I think the BBC announcing that they were cutting it, it's kind of like a twofold thing to me.
Did they definitely do that? Because I'm genuinely not sure. It was press released, was it? Can you remember?
Honestly, you know what? I'm with you. Good question. I'm going to have to go.
We're so well researched, aren't we?
I only saw a few random articles floating around out there saying that it was happening, and I don't know whether or not they announced it.
This is where we need Christian, isn't it?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I just, you know, it wasn't, to be honest, it wasn't anything I actually felt the need to research. They told me they were doing an edit. In the back of my head, I had the, oh, that's a shame. You know, like we never even got to see it the way it was before. But then when you think about it, the aired episode is going to be the actual episode. So there was an edit to it beforehand. It happens to movies and TV shows all the time. It doesn't mean that that's how it is actually meant to be. Once it's aired, that's how it's meant to be.
You know, I think the only sad thing about it would be that whatever the final cut was, there had to obviously be another edit. So technically, how the cut was before the edit was the way that the showrunner felt was the best cut, and that would have been with the beheading.
Well, so certainly. But my point is to the viewers, you know, whatever they see on TV, that's like, for instance, Resurrection of the Daleks.
Yeah,
it was aired as two 45-minute episodes for whatever reason at the time, some sports event or something like that, I don't recall. When it made it to VHS or DVD, it was originally split into its original four parts that it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
And then now recently it hit DVD again as the aired version, and I've never seen it as the two 45-minute episodes because I never got it over here that way. But to me, I prefer watching it in the two 45-minute episodes because that's how it aired. I prefer watching these things as they air.
Right.
Getting something that says it's a director's cut with extra scenes, that's always fun. Like the Five Doctors.
Yeah.
It's always fun to get more. It's always fun to check out more and see a story that you know in a slightly different way. But when I watch that story now, I generally watch the actual aired edit. In this case, it's tough because we actually know that an edit was made right beforehand for a specific reason, and the aired version was going to be different.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that happens quite often that they don't tell us about.
Yeah.
And it's not because of, you know, them trying to be, you know, careful because of something out there, and they don't want to stir people's emotions. They don't want to upset anybody. And I get that. But it's sometimes it's just, hey, you know what? This scene still isn't working for me. Before we put that out Tuesday, let's just get rid of it. You know. Mm. So it didn't bother me. If they had never mentioned it personally, I don't think I would have noticed that anything was missing, because I thought it was pretty clear. Like, if they wanted him to be an outright robot, then they kind of failed with that. But by having him say that he was half man, half engine, that told me that he had been upgraded, which, by the way, I'm noticing a lot of Cybermen links in all three stories, which is interesting. And I know we know they're coming back, but it's interesting that not only is there the Promised Land, but in every one, there seems to be a link to the Cybermen in some way. Get to that whenever. But if I had never known it was there, I would have, or it was cut, I would have never known that something was missing, because it didn't seem like it was necessary.
I must admit, I didn't know. I must admit, my first watch was casual. It wasn't in depth, and I never noticed it. So I was watching it like a casual viewer. And I've started watching it on a second time, so I've not really got to that point. But yeah, I think my only addition to this is, I feel the only thing that I always find a little frustrating with these things, and I agree, I've seen it written a few times, I think there's a fair point that the BBC's damned if they do, damned if they don't.
Yeah, true.
They so in a sense, I do believe this was done. It is a PR exercise, but these PR exercises have to be done, because otherwise they end up taking a lot of flack if they choose the worst of two evils, and then they have to do more PR exercises. So I think I can understand why it was done. I do. My feeling on it, on a sort of more sociological point, is, you know, you get people who there's the death for whatever reason, no matter how horrific, is horrific in every circumstance. If someone has a loved one who's been knocked over by a car, that is as painful for them as people losing loved ones in very horrific singular situations. And in some part of me feels that we don't censor television for those. Well, we can't censor, you know, an episode of EastEnders because there's been a car crash, and, you know, probably 50 people that day in a country may have had people involved in terrible car crashes, and, you know, that sensitivity can't be given to them. So there's a part of me which kind of feels that, you know, should you censor drama due to current events, and in that sense, because you can't do it fairly, because grief and pain and horror is so subjective to individual situations. So I always feel a bit tenuous like that. At the same time, I can see why the BBC and other such public organizations have perhaps an obligation to show that things that people are aware of, that they are aware of too.
I think too, like, you know, somebody begged the question, was, would they have told people that this was being censored had the episode and the scripts not been leaked online?
That's an interesting point. That is a very interesting point.
Well, because, you know, people would be expecting it. So people might be saying, you know, you might not want to watch this due to recent events. You know, this might be, you know, upsetting to you, to people involved in that, or close to that, or people who are just sensitive to that. The other part of it was, did they say it because they were like, hey, this horrible thing happened, let's be that company that lets people know that we care and we're doing
exactly
this. And I don't mean that in a negative way.
No.
But I mean, you know, like, you know, genuinely, if you don't toot your own horn sometimes, who's going to do it for you, kind of situation, you know?
Well, I remember a few years ago now, there was an issue where there was a UK spin doctor for one of the parties who had done an email, I think it was, which was leaked about how the party could use the Twin Towers to I think it was the Twin Towers to submerge some other news that they didn't want or something like that. And it did come off, it did look very crass and horrid, and yet at the same time you're thinking, that's their job, you know, that's what companies do, not just politicians, that's what companies do. And it sounds horrid, but someone has to make these cold decisions to, I mean, without wanting to go back to 2000 and 2001, I remember at the time there was being around the airports, and there was journalists swanning around desperate to get into the States, because of course it was all locked down after that event.
Right.
And they couldn't, they were trying to get in via Canada. And you could tell none of them were worried about or horrified by the travesty, or so at least the ones I saw. I can't say all of them, that's terrible. Sure. But if, because that is their job, not because they're nasty people, but their job is a desensitized job. And some people yeah. have to have desensitized jobs because that's what they're paid to be, totally cold and objective. And even people at the BBC or, you know, that's that what those departments have to do. They make choices which aren't going to be compassionate. They're there to either protect the corporation or to create a good image or to limit damage. And it's, you know, it's not a nice thing, but that's what some people have to do. So, you know, even if the BBC was doing that, that is part of commerce and industry.
Yeah.
So... Yeah.
Now, you brought up 2001, which brings up another question for me.
Yeah.
You know, after post 9/11.
Yeah.
Films had the Twin Towers edited out of them. Mm-hmm. TV
yes,
shows.
Yeah.
You know, showing films with planes crashing was really kind of not happening.
Mm-hmm.
If this episode had taken place in modern day Earth, 2014.
Yeah.
Some other country or some alien even doing the beheading.
Yeah.
I get the censorship more.
Yes, that's true. I can see
having
that.
It happen in an era where that's kind of par for the course kind of thing. It kind of seems like it's similar. And I'm sure, again, I'm not knocking their decision because I'm sure, you know, if you're close to the people who were beheaded,
yeah.
obviously it's going to affect you no matter what era you're watching it in. But so I, you know, I get their call, I get their choice, but where do you draw the line with these things? Because if you block the film, if you block in a film, you block the Twin Towers out of it, you digitally remove them, but then you also have characters talking about the Twin Towers mm-hmm. or talking about a plane crash, you probably would have cut those scenes too. Whereas here in this story, you remove the beheading, which as I understand it, the beheading was of a robot.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, still it's a beheading. So I get that, but it's a robot. So it's not quite as graphic as it was probably going to be, especially since there are children watching this. But you have a conversation between the Doctor and Robin Hood very jokingly about beheading. Graphic and jokingly for a fair amount of time.
Mm.
And when I saw that, I don't think I would have given that two thoughts. If they didn't say that they were doing a cut to the episode. But when I realized that they had cut the beheading and I saw that, I said, wow, you know, like, it would have been tough to cut out of it, but I don't know if I would have left that in, because to me that's just as damaging as showing the act. You're actually, essentially, you're talking about someone's head rolling and laughing as it does it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just felt like that's very graphic. Like, you're not just saying, like, oh, yeah, I hope they cut your head off kind of thing, which maybe you can shrug off, maybe you could forget 2 seconds later, hopefully, but you're actually going very descriptive with it.
That is a fantastically good point, because it was and it was quite a long bit of dialogue.
Yeah.
And it was you could argue that is trivializing actual beheading compared to maybe a cyborg, slightly over the top, maybe panto-ish sort of villain being I don't know. I think the only thing you can say out of all this is that you know, people who all sort of tweet angrily one way or the other, and I've got to be careful here, because obviously, you know, Casterbus has sort of made opinion pieces on this as well. You know, maybe it is a more complex issue, maybe there are a lot of ways, you know, you could have quite an intelligent discussion over this and see various aspects, and I'm not sure quite what the answer is. I mean, my initial gut was, you know, it shouldn't be censored. Yes, and then I was thinking, well, but then maybe there is, you know, if everyone, even people who are not involved, have sensitivity to it, and I think it has shocked a lot of people, some of the
sure.
recent occurrences, maybe that's wise. And then I think, as you said, well, yeah, but they left us sort of like a massive, and I'm glad they did, personally, jovial bit talking about beheading, which sort of negates the seriousness of removing a very minor scene. So yeah, I think it's an issue which everyone's got, you know, has the right to have an opinion on, and I hope that people can try and have a discussion on it sort of maturely and civilly.
I'm with you. I think it would have been better left in and probably would have gone more unnoticed, especially since if it really did involve a cyborg, it probably would have really, really slid under the wire.
Yeah.
I'm not knocking their choice. Again, they did what they thought was right. And, you know, it's a respectable choice, you know. But at the same time, was there truth to these other complaints about Peter pulling out his own and Jenna's hair in the first episode? Were they real complaints?
I don't know. I remember
seeing that. I'm sorry.
No, I didn't know about this.
The first episode aired, apparently there was, and I don't know if this is
I can
true,
I can
apparently
see
there was
it, yeah.
You know, there's people who have a condition where they pull out their own hair. I used to know somebody with that condition. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was whenever they would get nervous or start to worry, that was just their tic. They would pull out their own hair. But those people were saying that it was insensitive to them that he was just pulling out hair, making fun of them. And personally, this is where, and I may get some flack for this, but this is where I think the world has gone too PC sometimes, because he pulls out three strands, which is not anything new that we've seen in anything ever. And they're not sitting there making fun of somebody pulling out their hair. They didn't create a character who's just pulling out their hair. But if those were real complaints, complaints that you've already had, and you're already making an edit to your film, having the doctor two episodes later continue to pull somebody's hair out, you'd think might be another concern that they would have wanted to address as well. Now, I don't know the validity of that that claim for that thing, that for the hair pulling. I don't know.
The only way I could see it being a serious complaint would be more for the fact if you were worried that your kids were going to go to school and start pulling each other's hair out. Maybe I could see people complaining then, but I agree with you. I mean, how far do you go? I mean, could you not say that people being incinerated could be insensitive to someone who's had a family who's had a house burned down? You know, could you say that a daughter being taken into slavery, you know, there's a lot of slavery issues in the air at the moment, modern day slavery, you know, how far do you go? Car crashes.
It's got to be a tough job, somebody running the show like that, deciding what they feel should go and shouldn't go, you know. And so, you know, I'm not knocking that, and I'm not trying to like call them out for making the wrong choice on either of those things. I'm just curious, like, where do you draw the line? Like you said, like, where is fine line?
I think if my only feeling would be, if I was to go hard line, would be I would like to think that viewers had a little more decision, had a little more. Responsibility to change the channel if it's something that doesn't suit them, then perhaps you wouldn't have such issues for these organizations trying to decide what's going to offend or become a media issue, because people would just turn the channel. And of course, if you're suffering a lot of grief, I imagine you're probably not watching much television anyway. I don't know, I've not been in that situation, but yeah, sorry. I mean, you had a point, and then I think we need to move on.
No. I was just going to say it's a shame, because it's very much how I view the world anymore, in the respect that a lot of this PC stuff goes too far. A lot of it is great, because a lot of it does hold true meaning, and I believe it should be adhered to. And again, pulling a scene of a beheading so soon after a beheading in reality, I get that, you know. Mm. But it's kind of a lot of this other stuff. Sometimes some things that they worry about sometimes, and I really don't want to make it sound like I'm belittling things, but you know, the best comparison I have is you go someplace and you order a drink. Mm-hmm. You get your drink, and I'm not talking alcohol here, like let's say coffee. You get your coffee and you try to tell them, hey, you know, this isn't what I asked for, and then they tell you, yes, it is what you asked for. This is what you said. And it's kind of like, wow, there used to be a time when the customer was right. And if the customer is drinking that and it's not to their taste, it's not what they asked for, then you should just remake that kind of thing. And like you said, if this story, like you see a TV show with sword fights happening in it in the trailer, and you are upset or you are affected by the beheadings recently or directly connected to them in some way, it might make more sense to just say like, hey, maybe this is something I shouldn't be watching this week. You know, I'll save it till, you know, a couple years later, pick that one up, you know? But what my point is more so there, that it's just a shame that people anymore don't have that kind of understanding that like, hey, this thing did happen to me or is closely connected to me. Like I shouldn't expect the rest of the world to bow to that. And I know we all want to feel like that in those moments, and I won't knock that, because there's been certain moments in my life where you know, a personal thing cropped up in a film. And, you know, I felt like, wow, I could have dealt without that right now. So yeah. I do get it. And I, again, it goes into that fine line of where you you draw the line of what you censor, what you don't. But it is a shame that anymore the world just seems very much this is going to sound so rude because I don't mean it so rude. It seems like there's a lot of people out there that are just me about this rather than actually thinking about the people that are directly involved or how they might have felt, you know. And
One might argue that the lesbian kiss as an example, you know, is that really, if you don't like that, do you really need to complain? Or perhaps you just got to accept it. It would be actually quite nice if we had someone from the BBC's PR department on just to explain how these sort of things work. Because sometimes when you work within an organization, there's a sort of perspective that you see that no one else sees and doesn't see until it's explained because it's but well, I think we need
it's
to
a quick, tough job that
it, I think so I think yes it's a tough issue, but I think we need to move on. I think actually this week, if you noticed, while John, you're doing a great one of of Brian, I obviously Christian is here and James is not, and I seem to have been taking on a bit of the Christian role, so maybe I'm more northern than I'm trying to let on at this moment, which is very, very hard for me to
not
say.
Not having the butler was a good choice.
Absolutely. Good I fired him for the week, and just so we could play this out. Just one more thing before we go on to quickly to recommendations. I'd just say I popped to a convention this weekend, which was in Norwich. They very Norcon, and they very kindly gave us access to the convention, some tickets complimentary, so we could go and have a look. I got to speak to Ben Miller, and I saw a little of Ben's talk as well, which was fascinating. He talked about Johnny English and his an admiration of Rowan Atkinson. He did. I would say he nervously talked a little about the questions about the master, which I must admit I did post to him beforehand when I caught him at his table. He was obviously a little cautious. We'll be running an article, I'm sure, later in the week, so we'll go through what he said. I'm a little careful because he was I snuck a few questions to him. I saw him at his table and I jumped on the chance, and so I caught him a little off beat, so, and he was a little nervous that, you know, he might have said something that might get him into trouble, so I need to go through the recording and just make sure there is nothing that would get him into trouble, because we don't want that. But he was a lovely man. He was a great guy. The compere who was asking questions, I interviewed him earlier as well. A doctor who impersonator, a bit like yourself. He did a wonderful Capaldi. Nice. Very good. I think named Richard Ashton. It was a very nice small event. They had some of the models from various shows. I'll see if Christian can put those up. They had one of the original Eagles from Space 1999, Terror Hawks, the Battle Hawk, I think it was called. Was it the Battle Hawk, the main one? The Thunderbird 2 one? One from Space Precinct and some, and Galactica stuff. It was really quite nice. And as I say, Ben Miller was an absolute, he was really sweet to talk to. I think he was there with his kids, which was quite cool for them. Dan Starkey was there as well at his table. So, yeah, we'll probably be doing something about that later in the week, and we will talk a little about what Ben said about some questions about him and the chance, what would have been like to be the doctor and all sorts of stuff. So I think beyond that, unless you've got anything, we should go on to recommendations.
No, go for recommendation.
Do you have a particular recommendation this week, Brian Terranova?
Stroke, I do.
John Guiler.
I do. Pretty much, I think you should pick up any of the works by John Guiler. I don't know why I would be able to say that this week, but anything that guy has done, you know, he's just brilliant. Just go out there, find it all.
He's a peach, isn't he?
Yeah, totally. Just you know, you'll enjoy it. I don't remember if I'm going to recommend two films here, and I don't remember if I already recommended the one. I think I might have done on a podcast, but if I didn't, I'm going to go ahead and do it now. But first, I'm going to say I recently just watched GoldenEye again.
Okay, yeah.
And you know, I love Pierce Brosnan, and I love him as James Bond.
Yes, so do I.
So I really enjoyed that film. So I would definitely I would recommend any of his Bond films. My personal favorite is Tomorrow Never Dies.
So but right you're, now, you're not against Die Another Day, which I know a lot of people loathe.
No, I actually, you know, I'm one of those Bond fans that really likes the fantastical side of it. And when they removed most of it for Daniel Craig's era, not that they're bad films, I just kind of was like, ah, it's a shame. That's one of the things that I liked about it so much,
Same
the fact
here.
That it could go so fantastical. My main issue with Die Another Day is more so the extra amount of time spent on Halle Berry's character simply for a spin-off. Which I felt harmed the film.
Yes, I agree.
Whereas with Michelle Yao from Tomorrow Never Dies, she was an awesome character.
The funny
they
thing
spent. I'm sorry.
Sorry, no, carry on.
No, I was going to say, and they just spent like they could have easily done a spin-off movie with her because they spent a good enough amount of time on her to make her seem awesome enough that I'd want to see more. Whereas with Halle, they spent too much making her seem like the typical American film badass kind of annoying. Cocky kind of person that made me go, you know, this is a shame. I liked her, but I'm not sure I like her, but I like the rest of the film. She's still cool, but they're doing too much. You know, I don't save it for her own film. You know,
yeah,
this
no,
is a Bond film,
I wasn't keen on Barry. I was going to say Tomorrow Never Dies when I first saw it. When I first saw it at cinema, I thought, I feel this is a bit, what would be the word? I just didn't believe it. I didn't believe this whole media tycoon. It just seemed a bit far-fetched these days. I don't feel it's far-fetched at all.
Right.
Might have been a bit ahead of its time. I think my favorite is World Is Not Enough, personally. GoldenEye is good.
Look, I love them all. He's my favorite, and I really do feel it's a shame that he got cheated out of doing the Casino Royale version himself.
Absolutely.
You know, in my opinion, they could have easily done one more film with him, still be very believable, and then said, you know, we're going to move on to trilogies, which, you know, they don't do that film. They get two of their trilogy out. They have a writer's strike, and then they never finish their trilogy.
Yes, exactly.
So they kind of, you know, they just screwed themselves out of a fantastic actor just getting one more.
I think so, and it sounded like he was a little disappointed to be leaving the franchise as well, which was a shame. I still think he'd have been quite a good doctor in himself. He's got a little bit of eccentricity. I think he could have played it quite well.
You know, honestly, as much as I've seen him in other films doing so many diverse roles, I don't think I could argue that point. You know, I would have said maybe he was a little too straight or a little too handsome man or whatever. But no, I think he's got talent. And the other thing is, I think he's one of those great human beings too. I mean, if you look at all the things he does for. Charities and the way he lives his life and just the things he's done in his personal life that we know about, that it's great that we know about because it lets us know how awesome he is, but we probably shouldn't know about because it's his personal life, you know.
He's
just awesome through and through, and so I always adore his films, and that's what brings me to my second recommendation, which was when his film The November Man came out.
I
don't remember if I've already said this in a podcast, so if I did, everybody forgive me. If not, new people listening, go see it. It's a good film. It's a spy drama, which, of course, at least I know he's played at least three different spy drama films. You know, with James and the what was that? Tinker Tailor? What was that called?
Yeah, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Was he?
That's it. Thank you. Yes. Yeah. And then, of course, The November Man. And The November Man looked like it was going a certain direction. When you see the trailers, and I guess I kind of don't want to necessarily say that because if people haven't seen it and are on the fence about it, I don't want to tell them the direction it looks like it's going and then it's not. But it looked like it was going a certain direction that I was kind of like, I really want to see it because it's Pierce and it does look like a good film. If it goes down that road, it goes down that road. But it didn't. It faked you out, and it was good. And it really, even now, looking at him now, and granted, I think probably playing in a Bond film, it wouldn't work so much now, but he certainly doesn't seem like he's hurting playing a spy at his age or playing the ladies' man at his age. He carries it all very well. And the film was very well written. It was a great story. Some interesting twists. Kind of things, and I don't know. I just felt it's well worth it. So I would definitely recommend The November Man. I was very glad to hear it was like number two at the box office very recently because I feel it deserves it. So GoldenEye and November Man.
He was one of my actor cousins. Her friend worked with him on Mamma Mia, and said that he was very aware that it was not really up his street, and he just had fun. And they said that he was a really wonderful cast member to work with. He was always very gracious and open and jovial, so it's nice when you hear that people you admire are really quite the sort of people you want to admire.
Exactly.
So yeah, and I would recommend a Thomas Crown Affair if you've not seen that. It's one of the one of the few remakes, I think, which is actually 20 times better than the original. And you know, a lot of people like to think anything from the 60s is perfect, but no, that was woefully miscast. I think the 60s version, the Pierce Brosnan one, is a fantastic film. So yeah, if we're talking Pierce Brosnan,
I have to agree, that's a beautiful film.
It is. It's really good. The only recommendation I'm going to run this week is I am reading Matthew Waterhouse's book. The Boy with the Blue Box. I think the name's gone off out of my head now. We'll make sure it's in the show notes. Is it Boy with a Blue Box? Blue Box Boy. Ah, it's on my Kindle, so I can't even see it on my shelf. Yeah, I'm only through the opening chapters. It's really good. I'm going to actually see if I can get him on the show to talk about it if there's a chance, because it's a fascinating read. He's obviously very aware that people reading his book. Are very
Blue
interested.
Box Boy.
Blue Box Boy. Thank you, Brian.
Yep. Sorry to interrupt.
I'm glad you did. he's obviously very aware that people reading this are interested in the Doctor Who aspect, and he's very keen to let that float. And so far he's been talking from being a kid and being a massive Doctor Who fan. He does it, as he acknowledges in the opening preface, that he does it from a third person point of view. Which is very interesting. So it's, you know, Matthew was a great big Doctor Who fan. And it's actually quite, it's beautifully written. He's a funny, he writes with a nice comical touch to it. And there's a few little bits here and there which are popping out, which I think are quite ballsy, where he talks about some of the other casts in Doctor Who. And I'm just reading a moment, some of the other casts in Doctor Who were perhaps not quite as keen on the effect of Doctor Who throughout its history. You know, he's quite open and without being disrespectful. If you really hated Adric, I would suggest reading the books. I think it might give you a little more of a connection to the gentleman. And if I can get him onto the podcast, I think that would be absolutely wonderful.
I think that would be a lot of fun, actually, because when I see him in interviews, he is very candid about his time on the show, in exactly the same way that you said. You know, he's very outspoken about, you know, things like that, people not necessarily being as involved in the history and the show, but also about himself.
Yeah.
And his time on the show, and he's very much aware of the things that people didn't like about him, and how he acted and so on. And I think it's good, because I think you have to be, and I think it's interesting that not only can he be candid about himself, but he's not sitting there just doing interviews saying, I was an idiot, but everybody else is awesome. Maybe now people will like me. No, he's very candid about just the truth, period. And I think that's good. I think that'd be a very interesting thing to have him on one time.
I mean, from what I understand from a colleague of mine who spoke to one of the other cast, I hate being sort of vague and, you know, but I kind of don't want to sort of connect people too closely, but I got the impression from that cast member, who was one of Matthew's colleagues, that he was the dislike for the character does hurt to a certain degree. It's not comfortable, and I'm sure it might come up in the book, but yeah. I think people have got to be wary of that. I've seen that in a few fandoms, where a fandom can end up using one character as a punching bag, and it does actually affect the actor, because it is part of what they did.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you're essentially, it's somebody paints a picture of you.
Yeah.
And you look at it and you say, wow, what is that? You know, Bill, Three Doors Down. Is that Bill? It looks like Bill, you know, that's going to hurt the artist, because they're sitting there going, I just painted this beautiful picture of you.
Yeah.
But you don't even see it, you know? Yeah. And so that's the same thing. Acting is their art. It's their trade. And I get that. And, you know, I am certainly guilty of knocking off Adric and you know, River Song and people that I
absolutely
don't like and so on. And it's something that I've actually started to become more aware of, because certainly even in regards to Moffat.
Yes, absolutely.
I realized I've been very vocal about his era. And the sad thing is, the guy does have a lot of other things that are really like a great body of work. So I've been trying to be on the fence and be a little bit more even.
Well, we're only human, and we are meant to be critics. So
yeah.
I think as long as you say, we try and temper it a little and remind each other of things like Blink, or in Moffat's case, Girl in the Fireplace, you know, and on the ones that we really liked. And as I say, I think the only one I'm a little nervous about is the Pip and Jane Baker for Time of the Rani, and a lot of their stuff for Doctor Who, which I've never been particularly keen on. But they've done other stuff, and I'm trying to remember. There was one of them stuff which I can't remember what they wrote for. But so yeah, the bottom line is go out there, and if there's something you don't like, try and find ways to like it, maybe. But yeah. I think we're going to have to close up because we've got an audio boo time limit, which we don't want to go over. So yes, recommendations there: James Bond, Matthew Waterhouse, nice combo there. John Guiler, another nice combo. We will be back next week, won't we? For what's the next one called? Do you know? Can you remember what the next episode is called?
I believe it's Listen, isn't it?
Is it Listen? Is it Listen? where, of course, you'll be able to listen to us. He says with his slight Richard Whiteley countdown voice, and we'll see what we all think. I'm sure Christian will be back next week. And we will see you then, I believe. I clearly believe right.
I believe, yes.
Goodbye.